Come on, let's go to the Blue Hotel. I wanna live at the Blue Hotel.
When we talk of bisexuality, we think of she who crafted the ultimate definition of the beautiful B word. And she is at the center of study and conversation around it. Named by Teen Vogue as one of the most renowned bisexual women making history. She was chosen to represent Massachusetts on the Advocate's 50 States, 50 Heroes list. She's the editor of Bi Women Quarterly, has two anthologies, the 42 Country Collection, Getting By, Voices of Bisexuals Around the World. And this one, Recognize the Voices of Bisexual Men. Speaker, educator, activist, longtime Harvard associate employee, and now special guest of the Blue Hotel podcast. Welcome, Robin Oakes.
Thank you. It's so good to be with you.
Yours is the go-to everywhere, as I alluded, the most comprehensive way of defining bisexuality. Can you tell us about your coming to the definition and share it with us here now, because it's nice to hear it in your voice.
Like everything I have ever said or done, with very few exceptions, the definition of bisexuality, which is widely used and whose words I crafted, came out of a community process. I have the great fortune of being an educator, an advocate who travels around the United States and the world, speaking about bisexuality and speaking about identity and sexuality more broadly. And the best thing about that work is that it puts me in contact with people from so many different places who are engaging in conversations about identity and about sexuality and about, you know, what these words mean and what they don't mean. And so what I try to do in my work is listen very hard and listen thoughtfully and take in what people are telling me and then kind of compile it, organize it, and turn it into something that is relatively easy to explain to others. So it's really not my own. I didn't sit up in an attic all by myself in the dark, you know, creating these ideas that I talk about. Like everything I do is been workshopped, most very literally workshopped by the community, and comes out of that process.
So before you give it to us, how long ago did you put all of these thoughts together and come up with something so cohesive? And so you used as few words as anybody could to say so much. When did you do it?
Thank you for that. I mean, it was a process that happened through the 90s and into the early 2000s. The first time I ever published the definition in my Getting By anthology was 2005, but it wasn't new then. It was something that had been in use for some time. There were definitely little tweaks that happened around that time period, but it's you know, again, it's an evolutionary thing, and I'm not certain that it's done. It's actually stayed in its current form for a couple of decades, but it's entirely possible and perhaps even likely that sometime in the future somebody will say something to me that will make me think differently and, you know, change it yet again.
The 2.0, as it were. Can you recite it for us now?
Sure. So this is what bisexuality means to me. I call myself bisexual because I acknowledge that I have in myself the potential to be attracted romantically and or sexually to people of more than one gender, not necessarily at the same time, not necessarily in the same way, and not necessarily to the same degree. And for me, the bi and bisexual refers to the potential for attractions to people with genders similar to my own and different from my own.
It's so good. It makes me giddy to hear it again from your voice and to be here with you. This podcast has had 20-some episodes to date. And
wow.
And you were kind of at the top of my list since the beginning, but I didn't have the confidence to reach out to you until I had some history with the podcast and some success with it. And then I thought it's time to have you on. So again, thank you for being here.
Thanks. I'm pretty scary, I know.
I just didn't want you to say one of two things, nothing or no. No one wants to hear that. Bisexuality has been, it seems to me, the conversation goes here often, and I think it needs to. Among women, it's been fetishized. So people will fetishize female bisexuality, and they will demonize male bisexuality. I'm generalizing, but that seems to be the way it goes quite often with many people. Can you speak to that, both of those, however you want to?
There's a lot to unpack there, but one of the things underlying it is that many people think that for actual sex to happen, it requires at least one penis. And therefore, anything that two women could do together isn't that threatening because it's not, in their minds, real or serious. I think that's a piece of it. In addition, I would say that most men in the United States have been raised to associate the word bisexual and women with girl-on-girl porn. And in most of those situations, it's two women having sex for a man, like for a man who is the viewer or sometimes also the participant. And so I think that many men, when they think of bisexual women, they think of, oh, cool, I'd like to watch, or, oh, cool, threesomes. And of course, some bisexuality is probably that. But I would guess that most bisexuality is something entirely different. And to be bisexual doesn't require, you know, a male body involved.
Yeah, a male will often, to your point, put himself in the scene or at least imagine being in the scene. And that's the definition for some men.
Well, that some people, I should always qualify with the word some, that some people are threatened by the idea of male bisexuality is one, in their minds, for, you know, male bisexuality to be at least enacted, it would require for one of the men involved to allow himself to be treated like a woman, which in a sexist society is like, why would any man allow himself to be degraded? Like, that's terrible. That's horrible in their minds. You know, it feels like they're giving up power. They're giving up all kinds of control. That scene is very threatening. And also, of course, it challenges all kinds of bisexuality challenge the idea. I believe there's this happily ever after myth that exists, that every single person out there has one person somewhere in the world who is your perfect life partner, your perfect match, your perfect complement, and that your job is to search high and low until you find that one person who, once you meet them, will meet your every needs in every way. And once you're with that person, you will never again need to have any kind of external relationships with anyone else. You will never fantasize about anyone else. You will never even find yourself attracted to anyone else because you're now whole with your better half, right? And I think that myth causes a lot of damage. I think that if you live with that myth, the very idea of bisexuality is threatening. Even for people who are monogamous, like I've always been monogamous in my own relationships, but even there, like the idea that I could be married to my wife and still find other people attractive. Oh, heavens, how could that be? You know, and of course I do. I'm not, you know, one of my friends once said to me, we were walking down the street in Harvard Square and he was getting whiplash looking at all the guys who were, you know, who were on the street and passing by. And I turned to him and I said, Joe, you're a married man. And he looked at me and he said, honey, I'm married, but not blind. He said, looking is one of the great pleasures of life. And I just thought, you know, you're right. You're really, I had never thought about it that way, but I thought, actually, you're right. Like, it actually is a kind of, I enjoy those little moments when I look at someone and get that little spark of electricity. That's nice. That has nothing to do with my commitment to my relationship. It has nothing to do with anything. It's just like a little moment of delight. It's like seeing a beautiful sunset or something for me. It's lovely and I enjoy it, but I think that in our culture, that can be seen as threatening.
What do you think that we all try to think that we're not biased? But I think that in the 80s, HIV and AIDS probably added to the demonization of the gay population and certainly bisexuality. And that hangover is not going away anytime soon. Can you speak to that?
Yes. In the 1980s, you know, when we first became aware of HIV and AIDS, so much of the blame was placed on men who have sex with men, primarily on gay men. And then bisexual men were seen as an extra threat and often the way they were portrayed in the media was as these closeted married men who would sneak out and have sex with other men behind, you know, 7-Eleven dumpsters, and then they'd go back to their unsuspecting and always heterosexual wives and infect them with AIDS. Like that was the trope of the, you know, the sneaky closeted bisexual married man who was, you know, there was a whole bunch of stuff at that time about the down low, like at least, you know, in the Black community, like that, you know, all these men were like going out and doing all this stuff. And yeah, and then it just made gay and bisexual men portrayed as the culprits rather than as the victims. It made every man who, you know, same gender loving man, suspect and dangerous. And it was a very, very horrible portrayal. And also, I think, very harmful because it made it unsafe for bisexual men to come out.
It certainly made it that way for me. I'll tell you, those men do exist. I mean, the number one, it seems, prevalent word on Grindr, which if anyone doesn't know what that is, it's typically, but not all, men seeking men. It's all genders, really, though. But one of the most used words is discreet, down low, no profile photo, men looking for men for some form of sex, or sometimes just to chat. So those men do exist, and a lot of them are married to typically heterosexual women, not necessarily all, but typically. And so the down low exists still. But there's lots of happy, loving couples, men with women, who accept bisexuality in their man or are bisexual themselves or any combination therein. So honesty plays a huge role in all relationships, whether you're straight or gay. Or
that whole trope also is dangerous in that, first of all, I still remember once I read a study, and I don't have the citation for the study because I've never actually seen it, but it was a study of men who were arrested at rest stops for having sex with other men, in public bathrooms. And what was interesting about that study was that almost all of the men interviewed identified as heterosexual, not as bisexual or gay. And, you know, they had, you know, a myriad of excuses and ways to explain that. Like, well, we didn't talk, so it doesn't count. Or I'm married, so it doesn't count. Or I did him, he didn't do me, so it doesn't count. Whatever. Like, but they had all these different ways to justify and rationalize that. So one of the myths, I think, is that a bisexual identity makes you, coming out publicly as bisexual makes you dangerous. I think coming out publicly as bisexual makes you honest.
There it is. Being honest with oneself is a freedom that is unlike any other thing. I was reading lyrics from the 1800s. I think it was 1814, Robin, that the Star Spangled Banner, land of the free and home of the brave. There's so many contradictions in so many things. And that's one as it relates to the things we're talking about now, because you would think that freedom, there's so many brave people among the community, LGBTQ. But you'd think that freedom would include all of this stuff. And so when I hear that song sung, and I think about how many people aren't really free because they're being pushed down, particularly in the southern states.
Some parts of the United States, it's the freedom to control other people's behavior.
The F word, fear, it's a big one. The other F words I have no problem with, but fear is a big one. Phobia, biphobia is part of the equation. Let's dig into fear more. What are people afraid of? What are politicians making people more afraid of in the southern states these days more than ever? What is it? What's the root of it?
A sociologist would probably say that one of the ways that groups strengthen themselves as groups is to focus on an outside threat to the group. So a group is stronger if there's a dangerous external other, because it forces people to lock arms and, you know, coalesce. And I believe that there are a number of right-wing politicians in the United States right now who are intentionally, you know, using fear, ginning up fear in order to strengthen their own base, to bring out the base. And there's always been, I mean, this is like the story of history. You could go through almost every historical moment and, you know, find someone who was the other. you know, in Germany, of course, it was the Jews, right? Those terrible Jewish people who are doing all this stuff. And I'm Jewish, by the way. So I find that particularly, you know, offensive and awful. They also, you know, demonize gay people. They also demonize gypsies. They also demonize Catholics. They also demonize lots and lots of people. But all that was to create sense of self, strong sense of self and, you know, unity of purpose. And like, we must defend ourselves against these terrible threats. You know, in the United States, it's been lots of people as well. It still is, you know, Black and brown people, immigrants, undocumented people, LGBTQ people, especially now trans people, drag queens, like, which is especially bewildering to me. It's like, I don't understand anything. I don't see anything scary about drag queens. I think they're kind of cute, you know, and
the least scary people I know, honestly, the most fun people I know. I'm co-hosting with Lucy Flawless, an open mic during Pride Month in the town next to mine, Collingwood. And we're doing sort of an afternoon on stage. And it's the thing I'm looking most forward to this summer, because fun is sort of the F word there.
Books are dangerous. Like, all these things are dangerous. And honestly, yeah, they're trying to hold on to the world as it was in their perception in the 1950s or something, but the world isn't like that anymore. And they're trying to like squash down anything that would present a different possibility, but the world has changed. And, you know, no one gets to control what other people, no one should get to control what other people do or don't do. And I don't have to understand something in order to support its right to exist. I don't have to agree with something in order to support its right to exist. I just have to understand that different people have different perspectives and I need to get out of the way.
Here's something that caught my eye related to what you just said from social media about people who, quote, don't understand same-sex relationships, for example. The author of which writes, and it makes me laugh, I don't understand Korean either, but I still know it's a real fucking language.
Exactly. Like, there's lots of stuff I don't understand, but I don't understand why people go to baseball games. Go and have fun. Like, go and have fun. Just don't force me to go, right? That's like...
Speaking of trying to make me do something... It always made me laugh where the person who is phobic, afraid of gay people, it usually goes like this, and it's a man, it's a hetero-identifying man that says, I don't got no problem with gays as long as they don't touch me. You're the last person anyone wants to touch because we see it in your face. We see who you are as you walk in the room, afraid maybe that gay-looking person might talk to me. Phobia is a powerful thing, isn't it?
That quote is very funny. I have an Etsy shop where I sell, it's called Byproducts, BI Products.
I get it.
And proceeds from that shop go to support Bi Women Quarterly, which is, you know, quarterly publication I edit, and which is available online at biwomenquarterly.com for anybody anywhere in the world who wants to read it. One of my very favorite pins in that shop says, I'm bisexual and I'm not attracted to you.
Right. There it is. Just in case you were wondering.
And also, if somebody propositions you and you're not interested, there's actually a really amazing strategic way to get out of that situation is to say no, thank you.
Robin, I do have sympathy and empathy for people who, at any age really, because I'm not ageist, but I remember being college age and I remember being at a party and I remember a guy propositioning me. And I remember, and I knew later, I didn't know in the moment why it bothered me so much. It bothered me so much because I was unknowingly bisexual. I respond to those people now with some empathy because they're just not ready yet, whether they're 16 or 22 or 92.
Yeah, there is research showing that people who show higher levels of homophobia also exhibit higher levels of sexual response when shown gay porn. And then also, I'll also just add that I believe that people who are, and this is related, people who are entirely comfortable in their own identities don't usually feel a need to police other people's.
Love it.
Why would it matter so much? Like, there are people who make their career trying to, you know, keep LGBTQ plus people down. Like, why?
And most commonly, they're the ones that we read the stories about as coming out. Or getting caught, now coming out on their own. Robin, you're joining us now from the American state that has the distinction of being the very first state to make it possible to do something you did on the very first day it was possible to do. Tell us about this.
So I live in Massachusetts, which was the first state to legalize same-sex marriage. And November 18th, 2003, the Supreme Judicial Court ruled that it was legal, that the state didn't have the right to deny us the right to marry. And they gave the legislature 6 months to figure out all the logistics and details. So on 6 months later to the day, on May 17th, 2004, my wife and I, along with hundreds of other same-sex couples, got married. And so my wife and I were the first same-sex couple married in Brookline, Massachusetts. And it was just the most amazing, amazing day, and to be part of history. And also, I served on the board of Mass Equality for 12 years. And Mass Equality is our statewide LGBTQ advocacy organization. And so we're the folks who put together a coalition and fought against all attempts to make, once the Supreme Judicial Court ruled, the legislature tried to make it illegal legislatively. And it took us 3 years to fight that fight and win. But about 3 years later, we succeeded, and it became 100% legal and not open to discussion or debate anymore. And so I can't believe it's been 19 years, because May 17th was our 19th anniversary of being legally married in Massachusetts. And it feels like, and 19 years sounds like a really long time.
So coincidence, perhaps not, that May 17th is also rather important, annually recognized, the International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, and Biphobia, is it not?
It is. It is. And actually, we were married, I believe, before Idaho had been created as a holiday. But it happened within a few years of each other. And in addition, in the United States, coincidentally, or perhaps not coincidentally, May 17th, 2004 was also the 50th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision. And for those who don't know what that was, Brown versus Board of Education decision was the decision that struck down racial segregation in education. It's a huge, historic step forward for civil rights in the United States. So to be married on that same date was pretty cool, pretty meaningful for more than one reason.
In the 60s, Robin, and through the 70s, really, John Lennon was fascinated by the use of media and the messages that it sent out. And he and Yoko tried to make a point of saying not what they were against, rather what they were in favor of. In other words, they weren't against war as much as they were for peace. They weren't as much against Republicans as they were in favor of supporting a candidate that made sense to them. And thinking back to what you said earlier about, Nazi Germany and some of the stuff going on in the southern U.S. that wants to push down and push back anything that's not the same as us, the very us and them. It's a pyramid, because you at the top in your own little life, or you at the top wanting to have more power, and everybody below you, you want to come along and support you so you can have a great career. I've always said the job of a politician, first and foremost, and this isn't the greatest definition of it, but it's what's happened, is to continue to be a politician. And at what expense? Well, usually at the expense of a group that's not like you. We want all these people to think the way we think so we can get more votes.
It is frightening how many people were willing to go along with something that they knew wasn't right.
Because these guys, the DeSantis's of the world, and I'm giving him more shine than he should probably have, but he's a great example. I really don't think that he goes home and hangs out with his wife and teaches the kids to think this way. This is, to me, it's all an act. It's all a stage. It's all a way to get a gig that pays well. Do they really tell their kids that these things that we know to be untrue and not helpful and not humane, and I don't buy their shit. They're actors.
I believe they are. I think that there are probably some who believe what they say, but I think many of them certainly don't believe it, or at least they don't believe it to the extent that they promote it. And you're right. They're just trying to get the reaction that they want. They're trying to get a reaction. They're trying to get votes. And if anyone's thinking, oh, well, politicians don't make that much money when they're in office. No, they don't. But later they make a lot of money.
I think there's an encouraging thread here, certainly in all the things that I read from you and about you through your Instagram, Robin Oakes, and that is the youth. Now, there are young people that are drinking the Kool-Aid of their intolerant parents, so that's another issue, and that's never gone away. But there are a lot of young people that have greater attitudes than we were ever sort of indoctrinated with. That is, more live and let live, more acceptance of gay and trans and bi and all the spectrum. And you work, and you certainly have affected. Off the top, I talked about you being a Teen Vogue superhero. There's encouraging news around youth and their attitudes. Can you speak to that a little bit about what you're seeing and what you're experiencing?
Yeah, I mean, so much of what I know now, I've learned from young people. They, on average, you know, they've grown up much less encumbered by some of the restrictions, the thought restrictions that we had. They've had much more access to information. When you look at young people right now, about 20% of young people in the United States self-identify as LGBTQ+. In some places in the United States, certainly not in all, being LGBTQ+ really isn't any like big drama anymore. It is definitely in some families, and it is definitely in some places, but the number of places and the number of families where it's okay and where it's comfortable has grown dramatically. You know, most young people, you know other people who identify the same way they do. Most young people, you know kids who have grown up with same gender parents. Most young people, you know trans people or non-binary people. Like, there's just, they just have so much more information. And I do believe that media has actually played a big role in this. When you look at, my wife and I are watching Love, Victor on Netflix right now, and that's a sequel to Love, Simon, and it's like the story of their coming out stories. Their kids coming out, you know, and the fact that you can turn on any kind of device, whether it's your phone or your television or your whatever you're watching on, and see stories like this. There are so many things out there now that it still may be hard to come out in an individual family, but even those kids have the understanding and the knowledge and the information that they're not the only ones, and that other realities are possible. And I do sometimes wonder, like, how my journey would have been different if I had grown up with Mother Google, with the internet. You know, if I had grown up in a world with, you know, gender and sexuality alliances, GSAs, and, you know, in high schools, I wonder what I would have been like if I had been able to turn on the television and seen anything that wasn't like heterosexual and cisgender. Like, I wonder. I don't know.
Well, then you have me questioning, as you may have as well, what your job might have been, because there wouldn't have been as much need for the voice that you've given all of this if it had been so-called normalized a lot sooner. What would you be doing? What might you have done, do you think, differently?
That's a good question. I probably wouldn't be a quote-unquote professional bisexual right now. Like, I'd probably be doing something else, but that would certainly be worth the loss of a career. Like tending my garden, and I would probably be full-time doing environmental activism right now. And, you know, I believe that's really urgent. Anti-racist work is urgent. I do animal rescue work, finding homes for rescue kittens and cats, you know, from the southern United States. There's lots of stuff that's urgent. So I'm sure I would be doing something, but I would love to have my work become obsolete. I would love for that to happen. Like, wouldn't it be a great day if everybody was comfortable with, you know, with other people's gender and sexualities?
Oh, gosh. One of the reasons, it seems, one of the narratives among people who aren't comfortable with any of it is that, and back to drag queens, is somehow that the word groomer, these people are grooming my children to do what they're doing. And it seems absolutely ludicrous to me to assign that analysis on what's really going on. What do you do with that word groomer? What does that do for you?
What does that even mean? You know, when I sometimes ask, I've asked young people like what they think is going on. Why are the numbers so much higher today? Why is such a larger percentage of, you know, young people identifying as LGBTQ plus? And they just say we have information, and we have a sense of possibility that maybe you didn't have. And it's like, is an information is not grooming. I'm sorry they use these words that are just so bizarre. Like, are they grooming people to be Republicans? Are they grooming people to be this? Are they grooming people to be that? Like, what does that mean? And that they're using that word because it has the history of like sexual predators. That's not what's going on at all. And I just don't accept that language. I don't like it. I don't accept it. And I won't use it. Like, it's garbage.
I'm with you. Your own personal story, because you touched on it earlier, and I don't want you to say anything you don't want to say, and I know you wouldn't say anything you don't want to say because it's your personal life. However, you are not only bisexual, but you're monogamous. You're loyal to your partner, is what I understood it to be. People often ask, you know, how does that work? You're bi. Does that mean you just have sex with anybody anytime? I said, no, what we've agreed to, if I'm with someone, a partner, what we've agreed to is what we've agreed to, and being loyal is doing what you agreed to. Whatever that is, and relationships take many different forms. There's open ones. There's loyal ones. There's, you know. How has it worked for you? And is it just plain about honesty? And then you do what you do, and you agree to do it, and then you do that thing.
Well, I will say that sometimes when I say I'm monogamous, people think, "Oh, well, you're just thinking everyone should be monogamous." I don't really care what other people do. Like, if somebody else wants to be in a poly relationship, or not any relationship at all, like, that's absolutely fine with me. I think that each individual has the right to think about this, to decide what works best for them, and to engage in that kind of relationship, whatever that is. You know, some people choose no relationship. Some people choose to have, you know, two partners. Some people choose to have lots of partners. That's fine. Like, that is not any business of mine. And I support each person's right to make their own decisions. I think on this whole topic, I'm not pro-monogamy, I'm pro-choice. The reason that I am monogamous is that I can't imagine having the emotional energy nor the time to juggle multiple people's needs. That has never made sense to me. Like, I've never been able to imagine myself in a situation like that. And it's not because I think monogamy is the be all end all that everyone should do. It's just because that's what works best for me. It's simpler.
Speak, if you would, to the word fluid and fluidity, because I think that it's relevant and to a lot of people. And where does it come in for you? When did you first hear about that word, and what does it mean?
Well, the word fluidity the word fluid has lots of different uses. One is for some people, that's actually how they identify their sexuality. They identify as fluid, meaning that actually there could be a lot of meanings. One thing I know about identity is that if you ask 100 people who use any particular identity, you will get more than one definition. So when I think of the word fluid, what comes to mind is it can either mean someone who acknowledges multi-gender attraction, or it could be someone who feels that who they're attracted to varies at different points in their lives, different times, or it could be both. So fluid is a fluid word.
I've noted in promoting the fact that you're going to be on this podcast, Robin, to all of my music friends, that there's a special intersection with my other podcast, which is about music. It's called Records and Rockstars. Born in December 1942, months after John Lennon, of whom we spoke, in El Paso, Texas, a man sharing his last name with you, who was sung about by David Bowie and mentioned in novels by Stephen King and spoken of in sentences that include names like Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan and Pete Seeger, a man who wrote hundreds of songs and put out 8 albums. And like you, he made it his life's mission to stand up united in cause. Talk a bit about the impact on you of your Uncle Phil Oakes.
My Uncle Phil had a huge impact on on me, and I believe on my family. You know, he was a person who believed in speaking truth to power, in speaking out when he saw injustice. He wrote a lot of songs about civil rights. He wrote a lot of songs about, he wrote Bracero about, migrant workers. He wrote songs about all kinds of political things that were happening in the world. He fought really hard against the Vietnam War, for example. And sometimes in very creative ways. There was this one rally where they declared the war. You see, I think they were wondering what would happen if we just said the war was over. So they had the war is over rally in Central Park. And it was huge and it was amazing. And it was one of the ones I actually got to go to. But what I learned from my uncle is, again, when something's wrong, it's on you to do something about it. And my mom is very much like that. She's a major, community activist. She's always been engaged in, a number of different issues. Even at age 86, she's still, doing what she can. And that's how those are the values that I've inherited and learned.
I often ask the members of Fleetwood Mac, for example, I asked each of them the same question. And they enjoyed answering it. At first, they had to pause to come up with an answer. But I'd love to know yours around, if you had to write your own epitaph in a sentence, how would it read?
She made a difference.
And you really are. And I'm really thrilled that you came on the Blue Hotel podcast. You're a hero of mine, and I thank you. Robin Oakes.
Thank you, Jeff.
Come on, let's go to the Blue Hotel. Please take me back to the Blue Hotel.
The Blue Hotel podcast, just about every Thursday at midnight Eastern. Follow, listen, enjoy, rate, review, share, repeat. Thank you. Till next time, I'm Jeff Woods.
Come on a journey like no other, where you will discover many rogues that will lead you to a happier, healthier, and more stress-free life. And the beauty is, you don't need any vacation time for this adventure. The journey will come to you. Join Avery Rich on your very own journey into yoga. Along the way, she will demystify yoga poses and guide you into a yoga posture or short sequence, all in less than 15 minutes. You have nothing to lose but stress. The Journey into Yoga podcast. It's not for people who like yoga. It's for people who don't like yoga. Follow or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at averyrich.com.